I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm speaking today with Stanley Shostak. Stanley is an associate professor of biology at the University of Pittsburgh. He's the author of Becoming Immortal and the Evolution of Death, among many other books about evolutionary biology. And welcome, Stanley.
Thank you.
Now, Stanley's a former guest. We have an interview from a couple of years ago about Becoming Immortal, and this is kind of a sequel to Becoming Immortal. Do you see it that way?
I do, certainly. I thought it was very funny to write Becoming Immortal and then the Evolution of Death, but no one seems to get the joke.
Well, let's talk about the argument that you develop in Evolution of Death. You are addressing your argument to this notion that there might be a natural human lifespan or not, and what we might be able to do about that, which was also the topic of Becoming Immortal. What, from your perspective, what does evolutionary biology or cell biology have to say about this notion of a natural human lifespan? What are the principal competing ideas in that?
So far, everyone that's been born has died, and therefore the pressure has been on biologists to come up with an explanation for why we die, and the simplest is the most banal, namely, it's normal. We die because we have to. And the biologists seem to be happy to leave it at that. The problem is what is typical of the species also what is inherent and inborn and necessary for the species? And the answer there is no. There doesn't seem to be any reason why we can't live forever. In this new book, Evolution of Death, I argue that death is actually moving outward as it's improving. We are dying only now at a point of vastly greater efficiency than we died at until recently. And presumably, if we continue to evolve in this direction, we can push, or let me say, death will evolve even further outward until it evolves into extinction, and the extinction of death would be immortal life.
So part of the argument there is that there's accumulating evidence for a plateauing of the death rate after you get over a certain hump in the latter part of your own century. And if you can get past that hump, then people appear to have the same rate of death rate after that. There's no acceleration of their death rate.
Well, the death rate ceases to accelerate, but it is still very high at that hump. You're talking about Olshansky and others who have Stephen Coles, who have estimated the lifetime expectancy after 110 at about 50%, which means that the expectancy of death at 110 becomes 1 year. And if you make the next year, you have precisely the same expectancy, lifetime expectancy of 1 year. So after 110, it seems to be the toss of a coin, whether you make it to the next year or not, of a fair coin, whether you make it to the next year or not.
Let's pause and talk about life expectancy for a second, because you give a lot of attention to it in your book. Recently, the British Association of Actuaries decided to no longer issue life expectancies at birth for Britons. They know, because they think that the biological and technological capabilities of the future make that an impossible thing to talk about. What are the different kinds of life expectancy that people talk about? There's life expectancy at 65, life expectancy at birth, and so on.
Yeah, these are all drawn out of lifetime tables, and most conspicuously with extraordinary curve-smoothing capacities. So if you look at the data, they may be all over the place, but when you look at a life expectancy figure, a chart, a graph, it's a smooth curve. And that's intended. The obvious expectation is that lifetime is supposed to be mathematically congenial, and we're supposed to be able to draw smooth curves, and life expectancy should, well, it should be modified by way of risk factors so much so that if smoking is declining, life expectancy curves should move outward. These are all very highly manipulated functions.
Let's move on to another part of your argument. You talk in your book about the Weissman-Haeckel doctrine in biology, but let's just parse that out because it also relates back to your previous book, Becoming Immortal. You say that the Weissman-Haeckel doctrine was that the germline, that is cells, can be effectively immortal, but bodies can't. And your criticism of that is that, in fact, the evidence suggests the opposite, that cells are mortal, but bodies aren't necessarily mortal. Is that a correct characterization of the argument?
Haeckel and Weissman did figure very strongly in the what has become the central dogma of biology, which is that the environment does not work backwards onto the genome, that only selection can affect the quality of genes. And I don't think that's going to be supported in future science.
So you're referring then to some of the neo-Darwinist ideas that there may be mechanisms in our genome that facilitate accelerated evolution. It's not simply a natural selection process?
Well, you would hardly call that neo-Darwinist. I mean, that's anti-neo-Darwinist. The neo-Darwinists are the ones who would say that there ain't nothing that's going to affect evolution other than selection for small changes in DNA sequences.
So when you saw that the human genome had been sequenced at, what, now 17,000 genes as opposed to the 100,000 they were expecting before, a lot of people have pointed to that as a suggestion that this hierarchical set of selection mechanisms within the genome is more supported, this anti-Darwinist idea that you're talking about, that there may be just one tweak that we might be able to make that would change us from, you know, an ape to a human or vice versa, things like that. Do you think that that's, in fact, what the evidence is pointing towards?
No, that is a throwback to the first decade of the 20th century when de Vries was arguing for saltatory changes. As a matter of fact, that's the first use of the word mutation, was these saltatory changes in the genome. No, I'm much more inclined to think about large changes arising from peripheral populations. We only have a good fossil record for the most conspicuous members of a species. We don't have a good fossil record for those that are out at the edges, the extreme variants. And my guess is that there's plenty of extreme variants that can be selected for and produce punctuated types of changes. If you're trying to lead me toward a discussion of creationism, by all means, go for it. I'm ready. I would say, however, that I don't think that the creationists, and I've read Morris and Thompson and others, are that far wrong, that punctuated equilibrium is a huge deviation from strict neo-Darwinism and ought to be thought of as supporting a type of creationism.
Actually, I think that debating creationism is like shooting fish in a barrel, so I'll just stick to your book for now. I'm speaking with Stanley Shostak. He's an associate professor of biology at the University of Pittsburgh and the author of Becoming Immortal and the Evolution of Death, which is the book that we're talking about today. Stanley, in Becoming Immortal, you had a proposal for a way to create perpetual self-repair in a body by genetically modifying a clone and having it spin off stem cells. And it seems like you've moved away from that proposal in this book. You seem a little bit more attracted to Aubrey de Grey's kind of engineering proposals. Is that a correct interpretation?
Absolutely correct. You're right on. As a matter of fact, that was precisely the problem. Here I was writing this virtually tongue-in-cheek book, Becoming Immortal, about saying to people, you want to be immortal? Here, I'll tell you how to become immortal. Just get yourself a generator and keep producing stem cells. That'll make you immortal. But someone, I don't recall who, said, you know, if that would work, is such a thing also evolving? And so I had to take another look and see, you know, is there any possibility that we were increasing stem cell numbers, that our increasing longevity was a consequence of increasing stem cell numbers. And the evidence was very, very sparse, namely people over 90 years old seemed to have huge reserves of immune memory cells that operate in extended immunity. So their immune systems are not compromised, or part of their immune system is not compromised. And so I said, yeah, well, maybe, and then, you know, why not? So I thought about, if we are accumulating stem cells as a function of evolution, would that have extended life? And the answer was yes. So I had to rethink my premises in Becoming Immortal and put them into a much more positive, a less, I think, tongue-in-cheek mold for the evolution of death.
A lot of attention has been given also to telomere extension as a potential way to create cellular-level anti-aging or immortality. And more recent research has shown, as many people thought, that telomere extension is actually central to cancer, and so that seems to have dried up as a potential avenue of anti-aging research. Is that also your opinion?
I think that it's an iceberg phenomenon. The telomeres are products of telomerase. They can be manufactured, they can be lengthened, they are shortened during ordinary cell division, but their lengths are ultimately a function of the cellular physiology. I think we're just beginning to understand it. I know that Hayflick himself has condemned telomere theory, and we can probably follow his lead, but its relationship to cancer, I think, is probably vastly oversimplified. There's a lot more to be learned about the enzyme before we conclude that it's the telomeres that are the active agent in cellular immortality.
Towards the end of the book, you ask two questions. One is, why has death's evolution escaped scientific scrutiny? What is the part of death's evolution that you think has escaped scientific scrutiny, and why?
Well, I was at a symposium yesterday, and I mentioned to a colleague that my book is coming out, The Evolution of Death, and he said, how can death evolve? Death is the antithesis of life. It can't possibly evolve. And I say, yes, but we all say that it's part of life. Why can any other part of life evolve but not death? And he said, oh, semantics, you're just chewing on words. I disagree. I think death is intimately involved in life, and I can't seem to be able to make the case that its evolution is one of perfecting. I don't mean the good death versus the bad death. I don't mean dying in bed. I mean that if death is part of life, then we have to try to understand how a better death leads to more offspring. And my answer is that what we have in the statistics of fecundity is, which refers to women, is that women who have offspring later live longer. And that should be a very strong clue to the solution to this problem, that reduced fecundity is a way of prolonging life, and the reduction of fecundity entirely is the route to immortality.
It may also solve the other part of the dilemma, which is if we were able to conquer the aging problem and reduce the mortality rate significantly, we'd have this population dilemma. And already we see that there's this inverse relationship, that as people are living longer, they're becoming less fertile. And you're suggesting that this is the future of the evolution of death, that we will become less fertile and have more longevity.
Gee, did you read my book? You got it.
Well,
I worked that out with a discussion of stem cells, which I think are central. That the epiblast in the primitive blastocyst, the blastocyst, prior to what we call it the preembryo as well as the blastocyst, is shuttling these cells around. And they can either go into the germ cell compartment or into the somatic cell compartment. And my guess is that evolution is putting pressure on this epiblast in the blastocyst to draw cells out of the germ cell compartment and into the somatic stem cell compartment. And that's where the additional stem cells are coming from. What we have to learn is how to keep the stem cells going. We don't understand the dynamics of stem cells well enough. What we have now is some very good evidence that the division of the DNA is not symmetrical, that the new strand, the copied strand, goes to the cells that differentiate, while the old strand, the template strand, remains in the stem cell. If this works out, and seems to, we're going to have a totally new concept of stem cellness, namely the cells with the old template strand of DNA. Now, those will be strands that do not accumulate mutations, that aren't affected by replication, and that therefore have a potential to remain healthy forever.
So you think we might be able to locate a reservoir of those in the body and clone them and get them to produce more healthy? These other stem cells are going out with mutations and eventually their function is degrading. Is that what you're suggesting? Well, these root stem cells would have the original youthful function.
I love your root stem cells. It's not quite right. What I'm saying is that when we cultivate these cells in tissue culture and try to grow them in large numbers, that the cells are dividing symmetrically, which means that errors are equally likely to go to one cell as the other. I don't think that we're going to be able to solve the problem of immortality via those stem cells that we grow in tissue culture. The stem cells are going to have to be in us. They're going to have to be our stem cells, because those will be the only ones that will be dividing asymmetrically in the way that I'm talking about. And I don't have much confidence that this stamping of stem cells in tissue culture is going to provide a solution.
So the only solution is tissue engineering in our body and presumably through genetic engineering.
It is learning how stem cell dynamics are normally controlled and promoting that. I don't think we need to have gene manipulation.
Let's talk for a second about the politics of all this. Aubrey de Grey has been promoting his engineering approach called SENS for 5-6 years now, and gotten increasing attention. Many biogerontologists have rubbished him over the years, and you address that in your book, and you say that he should get more serious attention. One of the things that recently happened was that Jay Olshansky and a bunch of other biogerontologists decided to respond to Aubrey's challenge by promoting their own longevity dividend research funding initiative, and they're trying to get the NIH to commit multi-billion dollar research program to anti-aging therapy. They only expect a 5 or 6 year addition to the lifespan out of it. Do you think we're at a tipping point now where we could achieve, either through Aubrey's methods or other methods, or you know, through these kinds of initiatives, the breakthrough that would give us effective, limitless life expectancy?
I'm an enthusiast for Aubrey, and I've followed his career for many, many years, from his mitochondrial work. And that's the kind of approach that I'm urging, namely to get out of the genome and get into the cell. These cells know something that we don't know. And if we keep working on looking at the genes for aging and genes for, virtually for death, we're not going to find out what the rest of the cell knows. Mitochondria are there. They're the source of the message for programmed cell death, or at least one of the messages. We have to take a different approach. Cell dynamics requires much more than gene.
Stanley, I really want to thank you for joining us today. You're working on another book. Just tell us quickly, you're working on A History of Vitalism.
Well, it's a history, sociology, and philosophy of vitalism. I frankly want to bring vitalism back into the fold of legitimate science. I think Bergson had a lot to say, and he was right about a lot of it. So,
Tell us what vitalism is first. We'll just define it for a second.
There you go, right to the heart.
That's another interview, I guess.
Vitalism would have to be the notion that life has unique properties that are shared by all living things. That is anathema to most of modern biology. Biologists don't realize how unique biology is. They want to be physicists and chemists. And I'm saying, no, wait. It's the chemists and physicists who want to be biologists right now. We're the ones with ideas. We're the ones who are coming up with these networks and chains and what do they call edges and nodes and information theory that it's a major inspiration for physicists and mathematicians and chemists, but the biologists are still, we want to be chemists and physicists.
You'll be not surprised to learn that there's a new journal called Nature Nanotechnology, and its mission statement is that the only way nanotechnology is going to work is if it studies and models itself on the working nanotechnology of biology.
Yeah, I've often thought that we ought to have more respect for the nanotechnology of biology. I think of, I heard Kornberg yesterday talk, and these absolutely magnificent, breathtaking slides of the molecules in the polymerase II system. And, that's nanotechnology. That really is exciting stuff, and it's all coming out of cells. We're the inspiration, not the fall guys. We ought to be very active. I think that instead of thinking of the brain as a computer, we should be thinking of how computers can be improved by modeling after the brain.
Stanley, it's been fascinating again, and I wish you the best of luck with this new project. It sounds interesting as well. So I've been speaking with Stanley Shostak. He's an associate professor of biology at the University of Pittsburgh, author of Becoming Immortal, and out this week, The Evolution of Death. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, as before. And again, cheerio.
Stay tuned for a brief note about some response to Change Surfer Radio. Back around 1980, I discovered the Church of the Subgenius, which is a collaborative art project run by a bunch of crazed anti-authoritarians, started in Texas and has a whole cast of characters now and an international network of collaborators who produce sound and video and all kinds of documents that are based around a loose theology that worships Bob. Bob brings us slack. Bob fights the Pink Boys, and we are all waiting for X Day, which is the Church of the Subgenius's rapture and so forth. And there's a weekly radio program called The Hour of Slack, which is very funny. You can download it from the Church of the Subgenius website. And I was following some of the links around, listening to Church of the Subgenius stuff on the radio, and I found a small link that was labeled sexy neural primate grafting. And I thought, hey, that sounds pretty interesting. So I click on it, and lo, what do I find? But it's actually a remix by one of the Church of the Subgenius audio collage artists, Noral Pref, a remix of a Change Surfer radio show mixed down to 1 minute of audio. So here is that Noral Pref version of the Change Surfer show that we did on the topic of chimp uplift or ape uplift with George Dvorsky, one of the fellows of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. I'm Dexy. I'll be your guide for the next half hour. Dvorsky. White paper.
Human augmentation. Flesh out this idea, excited, changing into the cat man, titillated, you know, the augmentation of human animals. Looking at the spread, reinvent the wheel, post-humanist, post-biological, into that whole
primate neural grafting. It's actually out there.
Allow bonobo, they watch television. It's a little tweak here, a little tweak there, and suddenly you've got proto-humanish kind of an entity. Bonobo desires, so everything from increasing our
doing
would, but up, veil of ignorance. So there you are, in the veil of ignorance.
A loosey-goosey, maybe even fish.
Yes. Loosey-goosey to bona persons.
Neural modification could be quite destructive and harmful. Group sex, going to prison quite often.
I don't think so. Because we are still very little removed from our Paleolithic ancestry.
Sexy, and I hope to meet you in a sexy primate neural grafting. As with most of Noral Pref's work, there's a strange logic in what he chooses to pull out, and I guess you can see that that might interest some people to find out what exactly we were talking about. But you can, of course, find that at the IET.org website. It was a show a couple weeks ago. And read the paper that we were talking about, which is George Dvorsky's paper on primate uplift. So at any rate, Noral Pref is at noralpref.com, and I highly recommend his other audio remixes, all of which are available, about gigabytes worth of audio that he's produced of remixes of George Bush's speeches and all kinds of ephemera from around the world, much of it critical of the zeitgeist that we are in right now. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.